live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. From the University of Montreal, we're going to talk about maple syrup, protecting something in our body that can help everyone. And also, we're going to look at fast food may expose consumers to harmful chemicals. George Washington University, what chemicals are they referring to and what will those do in our body? A nutrient, a single nutrient, might counteract gene mutations linked with autism risks. That's really important. And I'll tell you which nutrient that is so that parents can make sure that they take that nutrient and give it to their kid as well. And black currants, rarely do people eat them. You can, in some cases, get them dried, or you can get the concentrated black currant, but most people don't because they've never tried it. Little on the tart side, but here's what you have to know. Its contents exceed almost all the other things out there. An important Finnish National Resources Institute study on black currants. And we're also going to look at hazardous chemicals and mislabeling are rampant in the olive oil industry. Yes, olive oil is one of the most important oils you can consume. But how do you know that you're actually consuming extra virgin olive oil when there's so much crime and organized crime's got control of it? And then some of the most important reasons why you should be taking ginkgo biloba every day from GreenMed Info. A new report details how big oil is spending how much on annual climate obstructionism? A massive amount. Our commentary is the violence of police politics. Counterpunches Steve Martinot. We'll share that. Something for the spirit to make us think, because Alan Watts, if nothing else, he gets you to think. You're it, he says. What does that mean? And with all of our shows, the intent is always first and foremost, empower people to make healthier, better choices in life. Maple syrup. Well, for a time, people didn't want to use maple syrup. They thought it was just, you know, empty calories like any other sweetener. But then all the research started to come in and show, no, that's not true. The latest is a brand new study this week from the University of Montreal. And what they found was that there's a lot of phytochemicals in maple syrup that specifically can protect the neurons in your brain, and it nurtures young minds. This was published in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. Quote, from the study, we wanted to test the effect of a natural product on the neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's. So Professor Parker had already discovered that sugar prevents the occurrence of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, in an animal model for the disease, the E. elegans worm. That's how we got the idea of maple syrup, a natural sugar produced and used by the body. So they did this study, and they found that by adding a small amount of maple syrup, that it made a difference, and at various concentrations, and compared that with a control group that ate a normal diet. And, at quote, after 12 days, we counted under the microscope the worms that were moving and those that were paralyzed. The worms that had consumed the highest dose of maple syrup were much less likely to be paralyzed. So that says something. And then they found out that it impacted the motor neuron. So just imagine that your person wants to protect your brain. You want to protect yourself from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, and any other of the conditions of the brain. Just having a teaspoon, that's all, of organic, highest quality maple syrup can make a difference. And it tastes good. So that's easy to do. George Washington University came up with a study published in Environmental Health Perspectives that showed, quote, people who reported consuming more fast food were exposed to higher levels of potentially harmful chemicals known as phthalates. escorting the study. And why is that important? Because, quote, people who ate the most fast food had these chemicals that were about 40% higher in their body. Our findings raise concerns because these phthalates have been linked to a number of serious health problems in children and adults. Why? Because they're known for their being, they're using packaged material, tubing for dairy products, all kinds of containers, and it leaches the plastic when you add heat to it. For example, if you went into a restaurant and you got some hot food into a plastic container, the plastic leaches the chemicals back into the food. And when you're microwaving, you're leaching the chemicals into the food. Like they put aluminum foil and then microwave, you're getting particulate matter of that aluminum, which is very toxic, into your body. And they looked at over 8,877 participants in this study, and they found that you're going to get these hormone disruptors in there, and that's bad, because you don't want anything disrupting hormones. So the takeaway message is don't eat the fast foods. Go towards paper. Get away from plastics. From a physiology study, this deals with autism, and we know that autism spectrum disorder affects the population around the world. In the United States, 1 in 68 children have the spectrum, and about 40 to 60% of those that have it are also diagnosed with some degree of intellectual disability. And the annual cost is about $250 billion a year just in the United States. And of course, our official governmental agencies refuse to look at vaccines, but that's the primary cause. The vaccines can then trigger mitochondrial disruption, and if you do have a genetic weakness or predisposition, then you're more likely to have it. So what did they find? They found that a nutrient called carnitine, carn, C-A-R-N, I-tine, T-I-N-E, it might counteract gene mutations linked with autism risk. Now, they're not talking about what causes autism. They're talking about that in their experiments, they found that L-carnitine protected the brain, and that neurostem cells create all the specialized cells that make up the brain. And when they divide to create two daughter cells, one typically becomes a specialized brain cell, such as a neuron, and the other remains a neural stem cell. A little technical, I realize, but this means that the population of neural cell stem cells is maintained in the brain building. Work can continue. Although this process occurs throughout one's lifetime, it is the most active during embryonic brain development. So if your neural stem cell population is not maintained at the proper level when the brain is developing, there won't be enough stem cells left to produce the right number and right kinds of specialized brain cells. And the result is that you have an abnormally wired brain. And so then they took a look at a nutrient, L-carnitine, and found out that it made a difference. And that hundreds of genes are associated with autism spectrum disorder risk, the surprisingly high incidence of the TMLHE mutations in human beings suggests the impact of L-carnitine or carnitine deficiency on autism risk is really underestimated. So the takeaway message is this. The science is there to show that prenatal carnitine supplements might well be worth considering. Mothers take L-carnitine prenatal because it could help protect the developing brain. And black currants are really terrific. This was from the Finnish Resource Institute. Quote, anthocyanins and flavanols, those are the natural chemicals in the fruit, a black currant beets, red, green, and white varieties as a wide nutrient range was found between each one of the in the Finnish study. So there were 145 different plant studies analyzed, and black currants was at the top of the list. So just remember, when you go into the health food store, go to the section that has concentrates, blueberry concentrate, papaya concentrate, and get yourself a bottle of black currant concentrate. It beats orange juice. It beats so many other juices. It's loaded with anthocyanins. Antho, A-N-T-H-O, Cy, C-Y, Anin, A-N-I-N. That's the chemical in there, group of chemicals, rich in flavonoids, that protect your body, protect your heart, protect your brain, protect your liver. And we do have those in grapes. That's why grapes are so powerful, so healing, so important. But also, you have them in black currants as well. Quote, the results show that although black currants are a good source of anthocyanins and flavonoids, there's remarkable variation in the varieties. So you want the black currant. And I also mentioned that I would give you some of the reasons why we should be careful about buying olive oil without knowing what we're buying. According to Natural Health, who investigated this, and they did good work on this, the many benefits of the extra virgin olive oil that I talk about all the time on this program, there are literally over 1,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature. But there is a problem, because it's been exploited by organized crime. Recent investigations by officials and watchdog groups in Europe have uncovered continued deception in the manufacture of olive oil in Italy. From mixing with inferior and unhealthy oils to adding dangerous coloring chemicals, and their findings show that these inferior, potentially hazardous oils are flowing to consumers at an alarming rate. The sick truth is olive oil containing motor oil fumes and toxic chemicals have been found. So consumers are turning to healthy olive oil, which is good, but you can't just buy any, and be careful not to buy the cheapest brands. Italian authorities completed multiple investigations earlier this year, uncovered fraudulent labeling, fictitious transactions, false documentation, and a complex ring of criminals that have since been charged with food fraud and tax evasion. And that's not the first time investigators have uncovered this type of activity. In one investigation conducted by Italy's state forestry group, over 10 tons of colored label table olives were seized. The olives were considered a health hazard because the coloring was added using a copper chlorophyllin complex, also known as E141, that is prohibited by both Italian and European legislation. So you don't want copper sulfate in your olive oil. So what do you do? Well, look at the industry's olive oil times. You can Google it. And in fact, the top-selling brand in the United States, Bertolli, has been the subject of a high-profile fraud investigation, as well as multiple class action suits. Choose wisely. And my suggestion is get the organic extra virgin olive oil. There are several good brands. Buy them from your health food store. Now, the ginkgo, which is one of the oldest trees in the world, has one of the most powerful healing fruits from it, the ginkgo biloba. Ginkgo, more like a little nut, has been researched, and there are thousands of studies. It's been used in treating over 100 different diseases. What can it do? Well, it can do a lot of things. First, it improves cognition, it limits dementia, and is great to prevent and help with Alzheimer's. Why? There was a meta-analysis of 9 separate ginkgo studies, and they found that it had remarkable ability for dementia and cognitive impairment. In fact, it was more effective than a placebo for improving cognition in patients with Alzheimer's and dementia. It just makes you think better, too. And then there was 21 separate studies that also compared it to conventional medicines, alone or ginkgo biloba in combination. And they found that, once again, ginkgo biloba had an improvement over the medicines. And another meta-analysis published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease found that a daily dose of 240 milligrams of ginkgo biloba was effective in stabilizing or slowing the decline of cognitive patients in, with dementia. So 240 milligrams daily is safe and it's good for dementia and Alzheimer's. And then there was 10 trials that were examined by Australian scientists that found that it had significant benefit, good for dementia, helps with schizophrenia, helps with tinnitus, helps with vitiligo, helps with arterial diseases. In fact, peripheral occlusive arterial disease is a blockage or a narrowing of your arteries in the legs, usually due to atherosclerosis, and it results in insufficient blood flow to the legs. Now, blockage can lead to intermittent claudication. You heard me mention this many times. It's cramps in your calves, leg pain, and ginkgo can improve pain-free walking times for patients with intermittent claudication. There was a randomized placebo-controlled double-blind study. They gave 111 of the patients who had the problems with intermittent claudication ginkgo biloba or placebo. And then they measured them at 8 weeks, 6 weeks, and 24 weeks and found that when walking on a treadmill, they did much better with the ginkgo. It helps you with migraines. The Italian study looked at ginkgo and found that it helps reduce migraines. And they found the specific chemicals, what are called ginkgoloid B, that does that. It helps with attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, inattention, and immature factors, improves that. Helps with glaucoma. In fact, ginkgo extract improves visual field damage in patients with glaucoma. It helps with stroke recovery. A study in the Journal of Stroke and Cerebrovascular Disease found that ginkgo biloba protects against stroke-related neurological damage. And a big time, and there was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trial of 102 patients with acute stroke. Half got a placebo, the other half received ginkgo. And after 4 months, 58% of the ginkgo patients reduced their deficit scores by 50%, where only 5% with a placebo group. It restores olfactory loss, so you have better smell. It relieves airway inflammation for asthma patients. It helps treat pulmonary interstitial fibrosis. It reduces arterial plaque formation. It reduces the severity of premenstrual syndrome. It reduces the long-distance vision in patients with macular degeneration and relieves the symptoms of seasonal allergic conjunctivitis. That does a lot. What a terrific nutrient, safe, easy, and just quite simply one of the best of the best. I'm Gary Nall. Now let's, before we take our break, let's hear what the great philosopher, the English philosopher, Alan Watts, and you got to think when you listen to him because he has generally one or two good themes within a simple, short message. This is called You're It.
In this universe, there is one great energy, and we have no name for it. People have tried various names for it, like God, like Brahman, like Tao, but in the West, the word God has got so many funny associations attached to it that most of us are bored with it. When people say God the Father Almighty, most people feel funny inside. But according to Buddhist philosophy, all this universe is one ta-ta-ta. That means 10,000 functions or 10,000 things, one suchness. And we're all one suchness. And that means that suchness comes and goes like everything else because this whole world is an on and off system. As the Chinese say, it's the yang and the yin. And therefore it consists of now you see it, now you don't. Here you are, here you aren't, here you aren't. Because that's the very nature of energy, to be like waves, and waves have crests and troughs. Only, we, being under a certain kind of sleepiness or illusion, imagine that the trough is going to overcome the wave, or the crest. The yin, the dark principle, is going to overcome the yang, or the light principle. And that off is finally going to triumph over on. And we, shall I say, bug ourselves by indulging in that illusion. Gee, supposing darkness did win out, wouldn't that be terrible? And so we're constantly trembling and thinking that it may, because after all, isn't it odd that anything exists? It's most peculiar. It requires effort. It requires energy. And it would be so much easier for there to have been nothing at all. Therefore, we think, well, since being, since the is side of things is so much effort, you always give up after a while and you sink back into death. But death is just the other face of energy. And it's the rest, the not being anything around, that produces something around, just in the same way that you can't have solid without space or space without solid. When you wake up to this and realize that the more it changes, the more it's the same thing, as the French say, that you are really a playing of this one energy, and there is nothing else but that, that it is you, but that for you to be always you would be an insufferable bore. And therefore, it is arranged that you stop being you after a while and then come back as someone else altogether. And so when you find that out, you become full of energy and delight. And you suddenly see through the whole sham of things. You realize you're that. We won't put a name on it. You're that. And you can't be anything else. So you are relieved of fundamental terror. That doesn't mean that you're always going to be a great hero, that you won't jump when you hear it bang, that you won't worry occasionally, that you won't lose your temper. It means, though, that fundamentally, deep, deep down within you, you will be able to be human in the pains, difficulties, and struggles that naturally go with human existence. But to have no hang-up, that is to say, to be able to drift like a cloud and flow like water, seeing that all life is a magnificent illusion, a playing of energy, and there is absolutely nothing fundamentally to be afraid of. Fundamentally, you will be afraid on the surface. You will be afraid of putting your hand in the fire. You will be afraid of getting sick. But you will not be afraid of fear. Fear will pass over your mind like a black cloud will be reflected in the mirror.
And that's the great philosopher Alan Watts. Clearly, a person who understands the deeper meaning of life. Now, for those of you who are interested in the real creation of ISIS, because they keep reconfiguring this on Fox News and other programs, and Bill O'Reilly just yesterday was saying, oh, we, you know, Obama's wrong for taking the troops out of Iraq. Had we stayed in Iraq, then this wouldn't have happened. Had we stayed in Afghanistan, this wouldn't happen. None of that is true. In fact, it was because we were in Iraq and Afghanistan that the proliferation of terrorists occurred. Over the weekend, I took a break, haven't been in a movie in a long time, and I went to see a movie called Eye in the Sky. I recommend it. It's an extremely well-done film. It's a very minimalist film. It shows Helen Mirren as a captain in the British military. She is targeted after 6 years, a terrorist cell in some African country. Could be the Sudan, could be one of those. And she's calling in a strike. And everything seems to be going all right. And there's the, like many members of the British Prime Minister's inner circle, attorney general, foreign minister. And then they're arguing the ethics of it, because one is a British subject and the other is an American subject. And so that plays out. And then finally, they tell an American in a sitting in a modular capsule in the desert of Las Vegas, which is where they do this, thousands of miles away, all right, you've got the drone, kill the target. But in the process, there's a little girl who is selling bread, and she sets up at this little table right in front of the compound where the terrorists are. So then the argument is, kill the girl. It's acceptable collateral damage. And one of the people said, no, it's not. And the others say, well, if those terrorists leave that compound, they can kill 80 people or more, and will. They're strapping on the belts. So the whole argument's a morality play. What do you do? Do you accept that you're going to kill an innocent little child and others around them, possibly, in order to stop additional killing? Each of you can make up your mind who see it, the merits of the argument and how it played upon each person, because each person had a different emotional reaction. Like the general, he could care less. You know, he's used to this. But at the end, he made a very good argument. He said, never tell a military person in combat what is moral if you're not there. In any case, I was thinking about this when I heard the debates, and I was wondering, surely Bernie Sanders will bring up how we have been the creator of terrorists and these terrorist models. We have funded them. Even in today's paper, there's a story how the CIA is going to give them even more advanced weapons, the terrorists, the al-Nusra people in Syria. There are no moderate terrorists. And what will that mean? Well, it's going to mean a lot of civilians are going to get killed, innocent people are going to get killed, more beheadings, more violence, more destruction, because we are inflaming it, because we want regime change. We, Israel, France, want regime change. But didn't we already go through this in Libya? And Bernie Sanders supports Saudi Arabia. Now think of that for a moment. Then why are his supporters not saying, Bernie, do you support crimes against humanity? He's going to have to say no. Well, then why are you supporting Saudi Arabia, who is committing crimes against humanity in Yemen? Hundreds of thousands of children are starving to death every day. Do you support killing of children, Bernie? He's going to say no, because of course he doesn't support it. But he does when he says, and has historically, you know, he supports the military-industrial complex. He supports $1.5 trillion, and it's a worthless plane. We don't need it. He supports the entire military-industrial complex. He supports our intervention because he supports Saudi Arabia. He even encouraged Saudi Arabia to take the lead. This is from Washington Blog. Quote, the United States is a major backer and supporter of the Saudi-led war against Yemen. The United States supplies the weapons and provides most of the targeting and military tactics from our satellites. The Saudi and American military are committing war crimes left and right. For example, a report from the United Nations Children's Fund notes, quote, attacks on schools and hospitals and the denial of humanitarian assistance to children continue to occur. The United Nations verified 51 attacks on education facilities, including schools and personnel. Human Rights Watch reports, quote, even after dozens of airstrikes on markets, schools, hospitals, and residential neighborhoods have killed hundreds of Yemeni civilians, the coalition refuses to provide redress or change its practices, end quote. Quote, the United States and others should pull the plug on arms to Saudi Arabia or further share responsibility for civilian lives lost. Indeed, in a single attack last month, almost 100 civilians were killed in one attack. Mind you, the movie I told you about had one girl who was blown up when they killed the terrorist. Here's 101 attack. The March 15 attack targeted a crowded market in the village of Mastaba in northwestern Yemen, killing at least 97 people, including 25 children. And yet it was a U.S.-supplied missile, a MK-84 2,000-pound bomb mated with a JDAM satellite guidance kit, also U.S. supplied. Even worse, hundreds of thousands of kids are starving to death. UNICEF reports that due to the actions of the United States and Saudi Arabia, Yemen is experiencing mass starvation on a scale last seen in Ethiopia. Over 320,000 children are at risk of dying of acute malnutrition. But the real numbers are much worse. For example, Oxfam wrote last year, since the start of the conflict, over 25,000 additional people are going hungry every 24 hours in Yemen, as the backlog and the fighting restrict food, fuel, and other vitalities. One in two people, nearly 13 million people, are now struggling to find enough food to eat, and half of them are in the brink of starvation. So this is because of Saudi Arabia, the most evil country in the world, with the most evil group of people on the planet. These are people to behead and crucify, who abuse women, who hate women. They're only there for sex and raising male children, have no rights whatsoever. But they buy munitions, and Bernie loves that. And they carry out our proxy war, and Bernie loves that. So why don't the people who support Bernie ask him this contradiction? You can't have it both ways. Now, one of the things that they could do is they could ask Bernie, if you really want to challenge Hillary Clinton, she was the architect of the takeover of Libya. Why should that concern anyone? Because I have posted pictures of Libya prior to the invasion and after on my website. Libya was considered the Paris of Africa. Now, we had been led to believe that he was this evil person, and his country was just filled with terrorists, and he was killing his own people, none of which was true. Here are the facts, and please share these with Bernie Sanders. Gaddafi inherited one of the poorest nations in 1967 in a bloodless coup and turned it into Africa's wealthiest nation. Of 54 states or 54 countries, his was number one. He had the highest human development index. He had the lowest infant mortality rate. He had the highest life expectancy and the highest standard of living in all of Africa, much better than South Africa. Gaddafi created a unique form of government. While being a kind of a socialist military dictator, Libya was also one of the world's most democratic nations, far more democratic than the United States. In fact, Libya's democracy made ours a laughingstock, and that little twerpy England and the constitutional monarchy, they're just pathetic by example. Libya's people, the people in Libya, held power directly through various committees and congresses. They had hundreds of thousands of these committees and congresses that voted amongst themselves and interacted with the central government. It was far more decentralized than Western media mispaint. So people had power. Women had power. When Gaddafi invited the New York Times to visit Libya and witness Libyan democracy in 2009, here's what the New York Times wrote, quote, "Everyone is involved in every decision. Tens of thousands of people take part in local committee meetings to discuss issues and vote on everything from foreign treaties to building schools," end quote. That was the New York Times. And there were literally hundreds of committees throughout the nation that any Libyan citizen could participate in. And although there were no presidential elections that could have removed Gaddafi or vote for or against a wealthy elite, as in the United States or other Western nations, Libyan democratic models enabled every ordinary citizen to make decisions regarding foreign and international and domestic and economic policies themselves. Terrorism and terrorist organizations were completely non-existent. In fact, in 2009, Hillary Clinton's own State Department called Libya, quote, this is Hillary Clinton, an important ally in the war on terrorism. Well, figure that one out when her and Obama decided to invade. Before Gaddafi, only 25% of Libyans were literate. At the time of his death, and he was sodomized with a knife, 87%. That's higher than the United States. 25% of all the people in the country had college degrees, and they actually had a brain compared to our college graduates. His greatest crime to Washington was his putting the interest of domestic labor above foreign capital and his quest to create a United States of Africa. And Libya had lots of money and resources and no debt to pursue it. He had gold, 120 tons of gold, when disappearing into the national banks here in the United States. He nationalized the oil wealth to create a sustainable, progressive social welfare system for all Libyans that dwarf anything Bernie Sanders would suggest. Free health care for every citizen, free education for every citizen, clear up through medical doctors, postdoctoral, free electricity, free interest loans, no interest on loans, a guaranteed house or apartment to live in that you owned. If you wanted to be a farmer, they bought you the farm, tractors, equipment, and seeds. Libya ranked at the top of the health care by the UN in Africa, number one. If Libya could not provide certain medical care for treatments or pursue a particular educational program, the government would fund you to go anywhere in the world, all expenses, to get your medical care. It was the first Muslim leader to pass a law in 1970, equal pay between men and women. Women had a right to education, right to jobs, right to divorce, and right to own their own property. Name me another country, Arab country in the world that allows that. Name me one. Half of university students were women. The UN Human Rights Council praised Gaddafi on his promotion of women's rights. If unable to find employment after graduation, the state paid the average salary of the profession that you were graduating in until you found employment. No unemployment. No kids with debt, like we have here, and debt peonage. You weren't thrown in prison for debt, as you are, by the way, in United Arab Emirates, like Abu Dhabi and in Saudi Arabia. Gaddafi built the world's largest irrigation system, dwarfed anything we've ever done in the United States, dwarfed the Hoover Dam. It was called the Great Man-Made River Project that made water available through the country to millions of people. Farmers were respected. No one's farm could be foreclosed on. You didn't have to use genetically engineered seeds. And by the way, owning a home in Libya was considered a basic fundamental human right. And there was never a middleman, never a bank, never a mortgage. If you were married, newlyweds received $50,000 or 60,000 dinar to buy their first apartment and help start a family. A portion of every single gallon of Libyan oil sales was credited directly to every single Libyan bank account. If you're a mother and you gave birth, you receive $5,000 in cash. The government would subsidize 50% of your new car they paid for. And you could buy 40 loaves of bread for 15 cents. Now that compared to today, where hundreds of thousands of Libyans died because of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and the neocons and Bill O'Reilly and the rest. A country completely destroyed, infrastructures destroyed, dozens of terrorist groups, including ISIS and al-Nusra and al-Qaeda, rampant and using it as training bases. No democracy, no rights of people, and that's a completely failed state. Why can't you make that a part of a debate? How you would handle foreign policy and the suffering or benefit of other people in other countries and regime change, or you wouldn't. So, Bernie, here it is. Will you denounce regime change? Will you denounce the military-industrial spy complex, invasion of countries and destruction of countries? Because if you can do that, then you're going to get some people paying attention. But if you can't, if all you're doing is playing this game until right up until the convention, and then you say, as you did on Charlie Rose, well, I will absolutely back Hillary Clinton. You're going to turn all these people all over to Hillary? No. There is not a single progressive that would go over to Hillary because of everything she represents. So then what do you really represent if you're not willing to denounce her for what she and her husband have created? Those are my thoughts. We're going to take a break. Please stay with us.
The boat, baby. Rock the boat.
ever since our voyage of love began. Nice to have you with us. Why is it there's so much environmental denialism? Because a new report shows, quote, from Common Dreams, the dark channels through which corporations influence legislation are notoriously hard to trace, but a new detailed report estimates that the world's largest fossil fuel companies, that's Exxon, are spending upwards of $500 million per year to obstruct climate laws. Dutch Royal Shell, ExxonMobil, British Petroleum, they're laying a lot of money to defeat any form of climate change legislation. I want to finish our program today by sharing something that is meant to have us think. It's an article by Steve Martinot from Counterpunch. It's entitled The Violence of Police Politics. Here's what he says. He says, quote, insofar as the state and the prison administration know that solitary confinement drives people insane through isolation and torture, its use signifies the state desires this outcome. That is a political desire, a desire to do damage to people. It happens silently as punishment for thinking autonomously, for self-respect against the violence of imprisonment, as a political stance. On the street, however, when comparable damage occurs, as when a cop shoots someone, he must give an account. He was reaching in his waistband. I felt threatened. Gary King. He attacked me and tried to grab my gun. Michael Brown, shot as he stood 100 feet away. She became uncooperative and made a threatening gesture. These appear as mantras to all parts, in all parts of the country. The uniformity of these excuses give them away as formulas, not reasons. They are tacit admissions that no threat existed, only disobedience and self-defensive resistance. In California, a small 80-year-old black woman, a grandmother, was shot 6 times as she stood in her driveway with a 1-inch kitchen paring knife in her hand for having ignored the cop's screams to drop your weapon. A black teenager in North Carolina, while undergoing some emotional trauma, was shot on his own property, in his own living room, in front of his mother for resisting being handcuffed. To disobey an unauthorized command is to defend one's freedom. For a cop to demand obedience under threat of arrest or execution is to criminalize that freedom. Inside prison, it is unfreedom that is criminalized on both sides of the wall. What is the same is the police demand for obedience, for acceptance of lesser status as a person and a withholding of rights. It marks the power to control, and insofar as it happens to people of color mostly, it is radicalized control. Control, obedience, and the imposition of lesser status, dimension, is a process of radicalization. And like all anti-democracy, it deploys extremes. A homeless man camped on a hill above Albuquerque, bothering nobody, faces 4 cops training their rifles on him. You can see it in a police video. When he agrees to come down the hill, picking up his bundles, the cops shoot a stun grenade and then open fire with bullets. They approach his corpse and, like demented drunkards, shoot him again and again and again while shouting, "Drop your weapon." He had no weapon. It is a form of dementia, able to shift from berserk activity to a calm voice in seconds. The cop in McKinney, Texas, I used to live near McKinney in Tioga, it's just one town over, ran around like a crazed man, rounding up all the black kids in reach after an integrated swimming pool party, leaving the white kids alone. He didn't say a thing to white kids. He threw a 14-year-old black girl in a bathing suit to the ground twice and pulled his gun on another who came up to help her. Then he goes on to 2 black teenagers he had handcuffed, and he says, quote, "I personally told you to get on the ground and stay there. What did you do when I walked away? You did just what everyone else did, which was illegal. You did it, and you got caught. Now you're going to pay for it, end quote. In the tones of a scolding house mother, he implies that we are all in some kind of military institution under any cop's commands who can then act as a commanding officer. Now, this may be the fantasy these cops live under, but the racism and the arbitrary violence that this fantasy unleashes as institutional power is unconstitutional in its abrogation of due process. It is the atrocious character of this fantasy that is rationalized, shooting anyone who doesn't accede to the regimented in that way. This wanton withholding of the right to dignity, self-respect, or sanctity of personhood through the use of guns and fantasy constitutes a political dementia. The term dementia, by the way, refers to the psychological condition of unbalanced reason or a crazed sense of reality. And anyone who's ever been, as I am all the time, around people with dementia, trying to help them, of course, using natural techniques, can see this. But it is political insofar as it involves profiling as the foundation for demanding obedience. As policy, it renders each cop an absolute threat to humanity. In 2013, in Liberty City, Florida, Tremaine McMillan, a 14-year-old black teenager, was attacked by cops for what they perceived as a dehumanizing stare. Didn't do anything, just looking at the cops. In a subsequent interview, an officer speaking for the police department calmly explained that McMillan's body language was already resisting an officer, letting the officer know that this person could become agitated and violent, and thus was an immediate threat to the officer. Spoken in an academic tone of voice, the psychotic nature of what is said becomes demonic. The teenager was sentenced to 2 years probation for looking at a cop in a way that they felt was threatening. It is the element of profiling that renders each incident beyond the law. Insofar as profiling controverts law enforcement, in law enforcement, the proper domain and activity of the police, when a crime is committed, the police look for a suspect to charge with the crime. In profiling, the police commit an act of suspicion and then look for a crime with which to charge their suspect. One has to be oneself beyond the law to place other people beyond the law. In addition, military regimentation is a form of absolute power over the individual. To have absolute power on the street is to have no one in control over oneself, and thus be, in a political rather than a psychological sense, out of control. In its wanton cruelty, the political dementia exhibited by the police parallels that of the prison system and expresses most clearly the police-prison nexus. For the police to act as they do, harassing and violating whole communities of color, they require a growing prison industry, and for a prison industry to grow, it depends upon the police acting as they do. They combine as a common political project. Neither can be understood without understanding the other. The cruelty in prison escapes being seen as demented because it has become routine. Solitary confinement is imposed on those who think critically and politically, and it can be imposed for decades in order to drive a person mad. We know of those individuals who have withstood this torture and survived, but those who succumb remain unsung. It becomes an expression of institutional political dementia that prison administrations can regard prisoners as imprisoned in order to be punished, where legitimately prison itself is to be the punishment. For the most part, punishment is meted out without justice in prison for the crime of thinking of oneself as a human. Do some respect and dignity as a human being. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day. See you.
hold me.